Hello, I'm Rachel Schofield. Welcome to the Bokomi podcast, introducing you to books full of original, memorable insights, or OMI, from the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, and culture.
Hi, I'm James Ball, author of The System, Who Owns the Internet and How It Owns Us. And this is my OMI for Bokomi.
In this episode, we meet the multi-award-winning journalist urging us to accept at our peril the idea that the internet is just too complicated for us to understand.
No, if nothing else, if our data is so supposedly valuable, if data is the new oil, data is us, you know, data is what you're interested in. It's the pictures of your family, it's who you're connected to.
In The System, Who Owns the Internet and How It Owns Us, James Ball argues that by treating the internet as an abstract concept, somehow magically sitting there to service our needs, we have foolishly obscured where the real power lies. He tours the globe, meeting the men, and they are generally white, wealthy, Western men, who control the tech, the cables, the investment, the advertisements, the security, the regulation, the men busy pulling the strings, while we are busy surfing and sharing and buying. James Ball is the global editor of the Bureau of Investigative Journalism and is no stranger to the internet's tangled web. As special projects editor at The Guardian, he played a key role in the Pulitzer Prize-winning coverage of the NSA leaks by Edward Snowden. At WikiLeaks, he was closely involved in Cablegate, the publication of 250,000 classified US embassy cables in 2010. If you think that how the internet actually works isn't worth getting your head around, James's book will soon change your mind. James, welcome to Bokomi.
Lovely to be here.
Great to have you. And the book really was fascinating, and it told me so many things I didn't know and that embarrassed me to realise I had never asked. And I think one of the key questions that you really start with, and we very rarely ask ourselves, is what do we mean by the internet? Because it's probably not what most of us think we mean.
I think it's just become so successfully invisible to us in the way that something essential is. You know, we don't spend much time really thinking about what happens so that we can flick a light switch and a light comes on in our house, or sort of the huge network required to sort of make it work that we can turn on a tap. And similarly, the internet's sort of become like that. It's a long time since we used to sort of listen to a dial-up modem make all its sort of beepy noises and spend 10 minutes online, cut off by the telephone. We'll check our phone, we'll look at our sat-nav in our car, we'll look at all sorts of other things and not even really realise that we're using the internet anymore. When you couple that with its sort of tendency to talk in really utopian, sort of magical terms, it really does sort of make you just gloss over any of the questions you might ask about it. The one I'm sort of always come back to is this idea of the cloud. And the cloud sounds great, you know, it's up, it's in the sky, it's magical. And what that really means is someone else's computer out in a warehouse somewhere. And so I think when we can start thinking about, well, whose warehouse and why are they storing it for me and what's in it for them, that gets us below that sort of first layer where we don't even realise what we don't know.
So we're wrong then, I think you're making the point, to think of the internet as what we originally see, what we immediately find in front of us when we log on, when we see Amazon and Google and Facebook. That's the tip of the iceberg.
They're kind of the bits that are using the internet. And I think, you know, as you suggest, we almost, any conversation about the internet tends to turn into a conversation about one of four companies. You know, what's social media doing to our society? Is Amazon too big? And those are really important questions, but we never actually think about, well, we've got this network that 3-4 billion people are on. Why does it seem to always create these huge companies? Why does data sort of work the way it does? Why does every single website require me to click something saying that it's going to harvest up all my data? It's, you know, if it was just some of them working that way, it would make sense, but it's all of them. Who actually makes the rules that say if I type in google.com, it goes to the company based on the west coast of the US and not someone else? And it's that layer just below what we see that I think helps explain a lot of how we've ended up where we are. And so No, I think lots of us are paying attention to Google and Facebook. We should be. But to actually go that layer deeper, I think hopefully is quite useful to us.
Absolutely. And we'll peel back some of these layers of the onion as we go along. But the place that you start and what I found really fascinating was the birth of the internet. And we forget that really this is only 50 years ago. This is a fairly new baby that has grown very big, very fast. And that the people who designed the internet never had any idea what they were going to see down the line. And in a way, that is at the root of some of the issues facing us.
Yeah, I think it's quite easy for us to forget, you know, a lot of these guys are still alive and still talking about it and reflecting on it. And the internet, what became the internet at first was a bid to join up four computers. Now, that's a bit more ambitious back then than it sounds, in that computers then were the size of a room. You needed a sort of huge budget to buy one. And they were trying to network up basically four universities in the US as this experiment to see whether networks could help research in maths, in physics, in all of this. And it was funded by a sort of subset of the Department of Defense of the US. So there was some government involvement right from the get-go. But everybody on this network knew each other. It was a couple of professors and a load of postgrad students trying to sort of fulfill this brief. And so right from the very first decision, where they were trying to make the very first connection, and they were literally, as they were trying to type commands over the internet, they were on the phone to each other at the same time to talk it through. Everybody on the internet knew each other because there were about 30 people. And it grew incredibly slowly in its first 10 years, 20 years. And it carried on basically being this small network, mainly of people in universities who knew each other. And so a lot of the decisions they made and a lot of how the rules were made on how traffic would flow or sort of what, you know, how different types of data would be handled were all done when everyone knew each other. And it was just this sort of research curiosity. And then because it suddenly started growing exponentially, we're still working off that system. You know, no one kind of had a chance to rebuild this. And so these decisions that people made for a little sort of poodling network in the 70s are now sort of managing billions and billions of people and trillions of dollars.
Yeah, and you make a really lovely analogy about the difficulties of making changes now to the internet, because it's almost like trying to make live changes to a rocket that's whizzing through space with a billion people on board, and it's hurtling and it's turning and it's twisting. And the idea that you can now go back into that and try and tinker is incredibly hard.
Yeah, you do end up with that sense of, well, okay, this didn't look like an easy job before we took off, but compared to where we are now and what the stakes are if we got it wrong, gosh, don't we wish that we'd done it. The difficulty is that, to overextend my own sort of rocket analogy, if there is a leak, you still need to fix it. You know, if we're losing air, if something's going wrong, if we're going to go off course, we do have to do it. It's just that we have to acknowledge that now it's an extraordinarily tricky task to try and re-engineer the internet. But that sort of means that we should probably get started quite quickly. And we should try and make sure that we only have to do it once every few decades. You know, maybe once every 50 years would be a good time. Because if we try and do this all the time, we're eventually got to blow something up.
But again, it's that really challenging sense that, OK, we decide something needs to be changed or tweaked. And it's not like you go, oh, yes, well, we'll go to internet headquarters and talk to everybody there and we'll make that change. The book spends a lot of time unpicking all the different elements and all the different people and bodies and commercial interests that sit behind the internet, and trying to sort of make any forward movement with everybody on the same page sounds horrendously challenging. Tell us a little bit about some of the key players that you see as having such influence.
So one of the sort of problems for the internet is that a lot of the equipment and the infrastructure of it is owned privately. You know, a lot of the key systems are the cables that run across the planet. They're all owned by cable companies. Some of them that you've heard of, people like BT or like Comcast, who deliver to people's homes. and then to companies that provide them with services and have cables that go across the Atlantic. So they've got some of the physical infrastructure. All of the data stores and the websites belong to your sort of Amazons and your Googles of the world, along with thousands of other companies. So you've got this incredibly sort of private sector space, even though it feels like the new public commons. You know, if you ever worried about sort of fake public space in the real world, then it's all that there is online. What you then have in between that is a couple of sort of institutions that have to try and keep the rules working. And quite sensibly, the priority for a lot of countries was not to have one of their rivals in charge of the internet. You know, if someone turned around tomorrow and said, okay, the USA can be in charge of X, Y, and Z, we might not feel all that comfortable with it. Other people would not feel at all comfortable if it was Russia or China or India. And so you've got sort of little bodies like one called ICANN, which is basically a not-for-profit sitting on the west coast of the US. It's in LA, in a little industrial estate. And they are ultimately responsible for deciding how every web address works. And they have to do that more or less just by consensus. And if someone really fell out with them enough and were influential enough, the internet could actually split. There's no legal underpinning. There's no UN for the internet. There's nothing like that. Everyone's been so worried about someone else being in charge that we've ended up with what we could most generously call benign neglect. Everyone's left no one in charge and is just sort of letting it be held together by goodwill and by sort of very, very exhausting compromise from all sorts of big fights, like how data should be treated going across the internet, to seemingly quite little ones. Like if you wanted an address of .amazon online, should that go to Jeff Bezos's company or should that go to people living in the Amazon in South America? And how do you decide that in a fair or a consistent way? And what do you do if people disagree on it?
And I sense from a lot of the people you speak to that tension in that on the one hand, you do have regulatory bodies who I suspect reading your book, you would feel most of them are doing their best in challenging circumstances. But it is, of course, the massive commercial elements of the internet that make it so much more complex. And you mentioned, for example, the cable companies. And we think of those as quite, most of us anyway, think of those as quite sort of boring companies. We just pay our internet service provider every month. And we think that's all they do. But you, of course, raise the point that they are out there lobbying lawmakers, looking for a bigger share of the pie, protecting their interests, as they would do as commercial companies. But we perhaps don't appreciate that.
No, I think because we see the websites we visit so much more, and maybe because for a while we actually believed companies like Google when they said, don't be evil, we feel more agitated about them. They feel more new. And yet the cable companies are still massive corporations with huge power, and they seem to quite like being able to sort of go behind the scenes or under the radar. Now, in the West, that's usually about them trying to get more profit or get different guarantees or to try and get a slice of the money that the sort of big online giants are getting. That can also mean them working hand in glove with governments to enable censorship or surveillance or all sorts of other things for political or economic advantage. And so you've got this sort of turf war that goes on, where these all need favour of governments and regulators with one another to decide how to divide up this sort of massive new source of wealth and of influence and of power between these different interest groups. And sitting in the middle of that, you've essentially got regulators who are using the toolkit of competition law, which was kind of invented for an era more than 100 years ago when we were thinking about trying to avoid monopolies in steel and railroads and these kind of things. And those tools worked in that era. They were built for it. And then we've spent most of the last 100 years with companies weakening them, watering them down, and learning how to get around them. And so we've got regulators who can only use the tools they're given by lawmakers who don't think about this stuff or understand it, sort of trying to fix a 21st century problem with tools of the early 20th century and wondering why it's not working.
What's also struck me is when you speak to people who are involved in those regulatory bodies, or even people who are very much on the commercial side of things, they are all of them pretty upfront about what does and doesn't work. And I really had to laugh, actually, that you have a chapter on advertising, and you spoke to a man called Brian O'Kelly, who some people would say was the father of internet advertising. And he said one of the first things he told you was that he uses an ad blocker. And it's just striking that the people who are at the heart of it can tell you exactly where the bodies are buried.
It's I was quite lucky in a lot of the people I spoke to, in that they were way more candid than I expected they would be. And there's this sort of strange disconnect between some of the more thoughtful people involved in the internet, where they can see that large bits of it aren't working for the rest of us, and they'll acknowledge they've had huge power in it, but they sort of don't quite seem to know how to get us out of where they are. But it's pretty rare. Brian, when I spoke to him, was still the CEO of quite a major online advertising company, and was sort of basically on the record at the open of the interview, admitted that he hated his product. That's not normal CEO behavior. And so I do get a bit of a sense that you have something that's become bigger than the sum of its parts, and the different characters involved in sort of making it how it is can slightly see a bit of culpability in what's happened, but feel like it's got away from them almost. And I guess when something is on a scale of a global network, it's got to be pretty hard to look and go, hang on, is this because of what I did, really? And so hearing some of that, and I hope hearing the explanation from the people who are on the inside, who have made it like it is, helps us actually start to understand the problem and move towards some answers. Because it's easy for us to sort of sit and say what we think works or doesn't, or what's wrong from our own perspective. I think to actually get on that inside is what I found took a lot longer.
We should point out that you yourself, you describe yourself as having at your very core, you are a creature of the internet. You're not anti-internet, but it sounded like there was stuff that you discovered that genuinely shocked you. I wonder what for you were the most telling interviews, the most fascinating people that you spoke to?
I think genuinely, to my surprise, I think it was probably some of the people who'd financed a lot of the internet that really shocked me, in terms of realizing you can't just build a normal good business on the internet. You know, let's say you wanted to start a restaurant in the real world. You might start one restaurant, you might be a great cook, that's the bit that you might have wanted to do. You hire someone nice for front of house. You could, let's say it all goes really well, you know, we're talking pre or post corona here, I guess, but you might have a business with 15 staff, that's a good restaurant in your town, and you're making a reasonable amount of money off it, and you've done pretty well. That would be a success. You'd be quite happy with that. You might, if you're ambitious, try and say, hey, I could open two or three restaurants more, have a little chain, I'd be really happy with that. And you might end up building a business for a couple of million if you're a bit more ambitious. Of course, some people end up wanting to start huge chain restaurants, that some of which work really well. And we can have all of those, and we do have all of those. The internet sort of feels like the way that it works and the way that people will give you money, it's sort of through a venture capital system to start up. If you're not trying to become one of the biggest companies in the world, they have no interest. And so anyone who wants to start a service there, you can't just try and make a medium business or a small business. You have to make this sort of huge, giant thing. And that means that you have to try and scale really fast. It means you have to try and keep people's attention. It means that you tend to work in this data harvesting way. And so much of what we worry about and goes wrong comes from that sense. And why do we have to force people into those sizes? Because it felt like some of the financial guys I talked to could see the problems with it and could see how that desire just to turn around huge returns really quickly to be the, you know, the Facebook multi-billion dollar sort of genius has really sort of, you know, someone put it, they all set out to move fast and break things. They've moved fast, they've broken things, and they don't really seem to have a next phase of the plan.
That really struck me, actually. I thought there were several ironies that you highlight that were quite striking. So there, you're talking about the fact that the venture capital system essentially discourages innovation to a large extent, and that these companies that start so wide-eyed and excited end up getting put through a sausage machine, which ultimately just sort of blows them up into something much different to what they originally wanted and makes them perhaps almost like a bland copy of everything else on the internet. Similarly, you make the point, there's a big chapter about advertising and the, one might say, insidious nature of that on the internet. But you make the point that newspapers, which we've seen have such a demise, people would say, as a result of the internet, have somehow, without even realizing, they've been complicit in their own downfall because they didn't quite see how things were playing out.
Yeah, I think it's been a real study in unintended consequences. I think a lot of the people, especially when you looked at the early days of the internet, these are quite likable people. These are often quite idealistic people. And so to sort of see some of the consequences of their decisions is that sense of this wasn't someone necessarily sitting down with a nefarious plan. And the sort of advertising one is quite interesting on that, because online advertising works by trying to guess who you are. And one of the ways that that's done is through cookies. They leave a little file on your computer that more or less just is an anonymous string of letters. But let's say you go to the newyorktimes.com and you get that cookie. And then later it sees you on a cooking website or on a comics book website or, you know, a cat fanciers website. It sort of then goes, oh, that New York Times guy has been on these other ones too. And it recognizes you when you come to other websites. And the sort of unintended consequence side of that is, if you're the New York Times, you want to show adverts and you know you're a premium audience. People who read that are assumed to have higher incomes, to be more educated, to be good consumers for all sorts of stuff. And it used to be that to advertise to a New York Times reader, I had to advertise in the New York Times. Well, now, if I can see your cookie, I can say on catfanciers.com, if you see someone from the New York Times, show them my very fancy advert for an expensive watch or holiday, much cheaper than doing it at the NYT itself. And so you've got this weird sort of unintended consequence where often without knowing it, old school publishers have given away their audiences for free or for cheap. And so that's sort of one of those where it's not that they were conned or it's not that something intrinsically criminal happened to them. They didn't understand what was going on behind the scenes of the technologies they were dealing with and ended up losing out very heavily because of it. And I think that's sort of part of my appeal of, we have to try and actually understand more on how these technologies work, because otherwise other people get rich at our expense on them.
You used the word nefarious back then, and we do sense at various points of the book the difference between people who are setting out to do something perhaps ill-intentioned and those, as you called them, unintended consequences. Governments, of course, come under the spotlight in the book. And as somebody who's, as a journalist, looked at the whole issue of government intelligence gathering online with Edward Snowden, Cablegate, we talked about in the introduction, you're very familiar with the role governments play online. And you're certainly not short of things to say on that in the book.
I think essentially governments, let's say particularly democratic governments here, essentially had the choice of, Did they want to try and exploit this whole new world sort of for their own aggressive advantages? Or did they want to try and keep it as a protected and regulated space? And they overwhelmingly decided to do the exploitation side of things. Because the internet sort of grew up out of the US, because the UK was an early mover and we have intelligence sharing partnerships, the US has always had this dominant position on the internet. And it's not bad defense doctrine to try and dominate those. And so the US did a huge amount of spying on the internet and still does. It's basically got home advantage. Where that has really started to come as short-sighted is that other countries have caught up quite quickly and aren't nearly so legally or in some cases ethically restricted in what they will do. And so the US likes to complain about Chinese sort of IP theft or industrial espionage. China does do it in some ways much more aggressively than the US, but is running from a playbook that the US began. If you throw in then information operations or all sorts of other, you know, you can now of course do physical acts of damage in the world just by hacking into internet connected sort of industrial systems or all sorts of other things. And so we have this almost militarized and certainly espionage-centric online space that's the result of a lot of deliberate decisions made over the last few decades. And we're stuck in the middle of that. We're the ones whose computers get used for, you know, denial of service attacks or whose personal details get taken to impersonate each other, all of that stuff. And we're more or less told to kind of buy an antivirus and hope. That's a little bit like sort of being told, well, you know, if we get invaded, don't forget to keep a kitchen knife in your pocket or something. We would see it as ridiculous bad advice and as the state neglecting it. And yet that's where we are online. You know, we've got a law of armed combat in the real world. We've got absolutely nothing like that for online space.
It's clearly something you feel really passionate about. And one of the things that strikes me as I read the book and that you raise actually is the fact that while there are some people who make this their life's work to examine the internet, to push back, I know you went to the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation in San Francisco, who are all about anti-surveillance, pro-competition, trying to get the internet to be a more democratic space. The facts sometimes suggest that most people don't care. And that actually they've decided that because the intrusion is somehow invisible to them, although there are these stories that go around about governments and big business, well, you know, people think privacy is a trade-off. I can sacrifice that because I need the internet and I need everything it offers me.
I think part of the difficulty is the upsides are very obvious and the downsides are all indirect. You know, we do hear people worry about the size and the power of Google or Facebook or Amazon. We worry about the control they have on speech. We worry about big tech profits. Some people do worry about government intrusion, but don't necessarily join that up with what's going on the internet. Whereas we do see the benefit of getting really good quality services for free. And trying to join up those things and go, actually, these are all a bit connected and we need to think about it. And it doesn't mean that we need to shut down the internet or it doesn't mean we need to start paying £10 a month for email. But we do need to work out where the limits are, how we do this better, how we make it more fair. No, if nothing else, if our data is so supposedly valuable, if data is the new oil, data is us. You know, data is what you're interested in. It's the pictures of your family. It's who you're connected to. If someone's going to make vast profits off our lives, should we not get some share of it in some way or another? And by keeping the questions abstract and keeping them sort of pushed away and seemingly boring, we don't engage with a lot of the sort of problems in our society that then manifest in other ways. And I always sort of liken this to the financial crash 10 years ago. And we kept getting told, you don't need to worry about what's going on with all these financial products. They're making more money than before. Why would you question that? Yeah, it's a synthetic collateralized debt obligation. You don't need to know what that is. That sounds really complex. They know what they're doing, it's fine. And then suddenly people were losing their homes and their jobs. And I think a lot of the time when I look at the internet, it feels like we're being told it's complicated, but it works. Why worry about it? That's for nerds. And I don't want us to be left at the time where it's losing us our home or our jobs or other sort of fundamental things we care about.
Yeah, and just expand that if you would, because it's a powerful argument you make, this idea that if we don't pay attention, something dramatic could happen. Take us into the future where we haven't put any checks and balances on this. Where do you see the worst case scenario? What is the real impact of it backfiring?
I think you can start to see some of it in what's happened when we've been at home during Corona. And I've used the internet more than ever, and I used it quite a lot before. But if we want to talk to someone, we need to talk on Zoom or Team or Google Hangouts. If we want to email, we need to do it through a major corporate. If we want to watch pretty much any kind of broadcast, it's through one of two or three major companies. It's become our way of being in touch with our families, with our employers, with everything like that. And it's all been done through the conduit of maybe about a dozen companies and maybe about the same number of large cable companies. There's no public space on the internet. There's no public forums. There's nothing outside of the control of this handful of corporates. Now, hopefully they're well-intentioned and mainly focused on profit. But that's a huge concentration of data. It's a huge concentration of power, and it's a huge concentration of money. And when that started happening in the 1920s with the last era of technology, people abused it. You know, people would use a monopoly in the railroads to start getting a monopoly in coal or in steel or in grain. And that's how it works. Market power begets market power. And the internet wasn't born in a vacuum. The people who have huge power on the internet, other than two or three big billionaires who rose up from the middle to the top, are the people who had money and power before. And if we let that keep concentrating, it will be exploited. And so we need to do what people did in that era and look at how you don't get rid of the technology. No one by the 20th century is saying, smash up the railways, smash up the factories, go back to, you know, subsistence farming. What they worked out was how to split the sort of proceeds of the new technology more fairly and how to put controls on the power of the people who owned it. We need that kind of new settlement for this new technological era.
And how much readiness and willingness do you think there is among, I guess, governments, because they're the ones who would have to lead this, and you think of the states at the moment, to take on some of these big companies, to look again at competition laws? Because, of course, we're well aware as well that some of these tech giants could outspend anybody if it came to bringing in lawyers and getting involved in lengthy court battles.
I think we're starting to see a change in willingness. I think sort of 5 years ago, 10 years ago, we all just thought these were the good guys or not a problem, or there were other things to look at. I think we're now starting to see what a huge chunk of the public debate and of public power has ended up in so few hands. And that is at least spurring a desire for action. What we don't really have yet is much understanding among lawmakers or even among regulators of the broader issues around this and of how this kind of stuff actually works. You know, when Mark Zuckerberg got called in front of the US Senate and one of them asked him how he made any money if he gave everything away for free to a company that makes something like $40 or $50 billion every year, the lack of very basic understanding, let alone anything deeper, doesn't bode well for action. But I guess you need the intent, then you need the toolkit, and then you sort of need to sort of go out and have the battles. I think we're quite early in it, but we are coming to a point where public opinion is moving, elite opinion is moving. And so it means let's try and make it sort of constructive action instead of stuff that just won't work or won't change anything.
You also make the point when it comes to looking at all of these things that we tend to look at them from a very Western perspective, and we sort of almost think of the internet as an American thing, or we think of it from a UK perspective. I talked in the introduction about the predominance of white Western men at the forefront of a lot of the internet. How do we change that? Because that is a cultural issue that has grown up over time that presumably is much harder to reverse, much harder to open up the internet in a more global way to make it more democratic and involve other countries.
I mean, the incredible dominance of rich white men on the internet, I think, is going to be very difficult to shift. But I think the balance of power and population is shifting itself. You're seeing quite a lot of leapfrog technologies on the internet, just as you did with phones in quite a lot of African countries. I've heard in Ghana, for example, almost everyone would access online services through their mobile. The average number of SIM cards per person in Ghana is somewhere between 2 and 8. You have Wi-Fi technologies coming in, all of this, to increasingly smaller and poorer towns and even to village areas in Africa, in Asia, in China. India's got all sorts of programs rolling out.
the balance of who's online and who's not is shift, and I would say it won't be very long until we're at a tipping point between there are more non-Western people on the internet than Western, you know, if we've not crossed that line already. What we then need to do is to try and make sure that we don't just end up siloing into different internets. A global network is a potentially huge upside. We need to get used to there being Chinese internet giants, but what's the biggest European internet company you can think of? There's hardly any, you know, let alone an African one or a South American one. We need to try and find some large internet companies and service providers not in the US, but that does mean essentially non-US countries getting the confidence to actually challenge some of these things and take some of it on, instead of just sort of trying to, as the EU sort of regulators do, every now and then just curb the big US companies a little bit and otherwise let them keep on. You know, if the internet's got to be a global network, it's got to reflect the world.
And yet we see, you've mentioned China a couple of times, we see China coming into play massively here. And there we just create another giant that sits staring at the USA and threatens to just become a two-player market again and be equally dominant to the States and keep other people out, and some would say in a more sinister way.
Exactly that. And our inaction doesn't mean that things stay as they are. The internet is changing and will continue to change. We do think in the offline world, China's probably on the course to become the world's dominant power. If we were uncomfortable with US norms, you would think that quite a lot of Chinese norms we would be uncomfortable with. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't welcome Chinese companies on the internet, shouldn't use Chinese services, but we know that they have very different attitudes towards human rights, towards surveillance, towards freedom, than the values that are central to quite a lot of countries online and offline. And if we just sit back and don't try and grasp this stuff now and actually get a kind of global system for how we run the internet, how the rules should work, if we don't sort of try at least something multilateral or to assert ourselves, we will just end up with this bipolar world where the rules get handed to us.
James Ball, that is a fascinating place and a fascinating challenge on which to end. Thank you so much for sharing your OMI with us today. And you can get a copy of James's book, The System, Who Owns the Internet and How It Owns Us, which is out now, by clicking on the link in the podcast description. And if you would like to hear more from the most wanted minds in business, science, technology and culture, please do subscribe on your chosen audio platform, where you can also like and review us. Do also sign up to our most wanted email at bocomi.com. That way you'll get news of upcoming guests and access to our author intelligence service for clubs and companies. I'm Rachel Schofield. Thanks for listening. Until next time, goodbye. I love Bocomi.